Okay, Jorge, if you want to start.
Sure, let's start then. Kevin?
Are you ready to start?
Yes.
Okay. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
And not too loud or not too quiet?
Just right.
Okay.
Just fine.
Okay, so I'm going to be talking about recent work in collaboration with Christian Bohmer. It's been published in TRD, and you can find the archive number on the title page there. And we're trying to look at loop quantum effects and how they affect the interior of the Schwarzschild black hole. So if you can move to the next slide, to the first slide. So this is kind of coming after some recent advances in loop quantum cosmology. Is someone dialing in right now?
Yeah, but you can continue.
Continue? Okay. In the last year, year and a half, I guess, and the major results are that we see a replacement of the Big Bang singularity, with a big bounce when we're looking at Friedman, Robertson, Walker isotropic cosmologies. And that's work starting with Ashtekar, Pavlovsky, and Singh last year, and I've been involved in some of that. But the major advance that went on was the ability to complete the full quantum program of loop quantum cosmology. And in particular, we've been able to construct a physical Hilbert space, physical inner product, compute Dirac observables, and evolve physical semi-classical states and compute the Dirac observables. In the case where we have a simple model of the FRW spacetime with matter in the form of a massless scalar field. And going through those advances, we found that this Big Bang is replaced with a Big Bounce. There's also been another advance in that the original loop quantum cosmology Hamiltonian constraint, we've kind of found that it has a bad semi-classical limit. And there's been a new, improved Hamiltonian constraint operator constructed. And we kind of colloquially call it the mu-bar quantization versus the original mu-naught. So the mu-naught quantization would have the bad semi-classical limit, whereas the mu-bar quantization would not. And what we found is more physical results, that they make sense on a more physical level, and that they have a good semi-classical limit. And this was shown last year in this, the same work. So in order to extend, what we'd like to do is obviously extend these rigorous results to more complicated scenarios. You know, one possibility is relaxing the assumption of isotropy or going on to even more challenging models. But it turns out to be quite challenging, obviously, because the models become more complex. So one thing that would be nice is, could we have kind of an approximate shortcut to the physical predictions in an approximate sense. And what it was shown in the isotropic case was that there was a kind of understanding, and that there was a phenomenological effective theory where if you incorporate the holonomy features of the Hamiltonian constraint, you can, into a kind of a semi-classical model of the theory, then you can provide an explanation for the bounce. And what happens is that in that model, the Friedman equation gets modified with a term that's quadratic in the energy density. It goes with an overall minus sign. And then if you can see from the Friedman equation there that when the energy density hits a critical value, the rho c, then gravity acts repulsively, and that's where the bounce occurs. And so what one would then might ask, well, does that actually approximate the quantum results, and does it approximate it well? And that was shown to be the case. But in this sort of this simple model with a massless scalar field. And one of the things that comes out is if you look at the Mu-bar quantization, what we find is that this rho c, this critical energy density, is Planckian. And that might be what you'd expect from a quantum theory of cosmology. Whereas if you look at the original mu-naught quantization, you could find that this critical density can be arbitrarily small. And that doesn't seem to make much sense. So if we can go to the next slide. So what I want to talk about today is what can we say, can we extend some of these results to black hole singularities, what will happen in that case? And the simplest thing to look at is the interior of a Schwarzschild black hole, because it can be treated as a homogeneous but anisotropic, a Kantosky-Sachs type model. And this sort of loop quantization, the initial loop quantization of this interior has been done by Eshtekar and Boyevol in 2006, but their quantization was analogous to the mu-naught quantization of loop quantum cosmology. Although, they're very similar. Quantizing this simple model is quite similar to loop quantum cosmology, since it's a homogeneous model. To the next slide. So I'm just going to describe right now the classical framework for the Schwarzschild interior. And it's homogeneous in the sense that if you flip the usual Schwarzschild temporal and radial coordinates, then the metric components are now only depending on the temporal, a new temporal coordinate. And so your metric is given there. You have the lapse function multiplied as just a function of time multiplying the dt, the temporal part of the metric. And then you have 2 degrees of freedom for the metric, spatial degrees of freedom. You have the g, well, x here is the new radial coordinate. And so you have a gxx metric component that's a function of t, and then you have the two-sphere metric, the d omega squared there, so you have a g omega omega. That would be the other component of the spatial metric. Now, again, it's just a function of time. So in this sense, we now have 2 spatial degrees of freedom for the metric, so it's an anisotropic model, but it's homogeneous in the sense they're only time-dependent components. And then it's given explicitly, you see the form right there, with the line element, you have the lapse square term is just 2m over t minus 1, the inverse of that, and that should be familiar from the Schwarzschild metric. So again, they're homogeneous. It's a homogeneous metric, but it's an anisotropic type, and there's 2 dynamical spatial components of the metric. The d omega squared is just your ordinary unit two-sphere metric, and so the g omega omega component of the metric is what's going to determine the physical radius of the two-sphere. And we're going to use that to interpret the results from the effect of the quantum results. The topologies are across SO3, so the radial coordinate x is can take on all values, all real values. And the Schwarzschild interior is recovered when you look at the range of the temporal coordinates going from 0 to 2 times the mass. Okay, so if we can go on to the next slide. So the goal is, of course, to quantize this theory, and using techniques that are familiar from loop quantum cosmology and obviously from loop quantum gravity. So we need to describe this classical framework in terms of connection and triad variables. And the idea is the same idea in loop quantum cosmology. You'd want to assume the Kantosky-Sachs symmetry for your connection and triad. So you're reducing these triads, the connection and triad variables at the classical level, and then you insert the reduced variables into the Hamiltonian and quantize the symmetry reduced degrees of freedom. So it's completely analogous to loop quantum cosmology. So when we look at the triad, it's going to be determined now by two dynamical quantities, which we label as P, B, and PC. And they are related, since the triad is related to the to the three metric, the spatial metric, they are going to be related to the two metric degrees of freedom, the GXX, the radial part, and the two-sphere part, G omega omega. And it's given in the following equation, GXX is just PB squared over PC, and then G omega omega is the absolute value of PC. So just using that, you plug that right into the, and you, into the metric, and you get the line element right below that. The connection is also going to be determined by two dynamical quantities, and just label that B and C. And the B is going to be conjugate to the triad component PB, obviously, and C is going to be conjugate to PC. And the Poisson brackets are given right there. You have B and PB are conjugate, with a Poisson bracket given by G times the Mirzi parameter, and then C and PC are conjugate, and all other Poisson brackets are going to vanish. Finally, if we plug in these variables into the Hamiltonian, we get the Hamiltonian given right there. So it looks somewhat similar to a loop quantum cosmology framework. You have kind of, it's quadratic in connection components. You have B squared term there. You have a B times C term. And then it goes as a square root of a triad component, like square root of PC on the first term, or PB over square root of PC, which is quite similar to loop quantum cosmology. Okay, if we can move on to the next slide. So once we have the Hamiltonian and we have the basic Poisson structure, we have the basic variables, we can just go forth and derive the equations of motion. And they're given by the standard Hamilton's equations. So the time derivative of PB, for instance, the triad component PB, is just given by the Poisson bracket of that variable with a Hamiltonian. And that's just given through the Poisson brackets, just proportional to the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the connection component B, and so forth. You can do that for all of the phase-based variables. And, of course, the Hamiltonian is constrained to be... Hamiltonian is a constraint, so it should vanish also, giving us an equation of motion. I'd like to be able to identify, at least at the classical level, where is the horizon and where is the singularity in terms of these triad variables, because all the effective dynamics is going to be based on the triad variables and not the metric variables. So for the horizon, if we go back one slide. The horizon is given when the G omega omega term is equal to 2m, and when the GXX term is equal to 0. And so that means that this value of the PC component is going to be given by 2m, and the value of the PB component is 0 at the horizon. Okay. And that's given on that slide number 5. So PB equals 0 at the horizon, and PC is non-zero in proportional to the mass squared. And similarly for the singularity, if we go back to slide 4, the singularity is given when G omega omega is 0, and also when GXX is 0. Is GXX 0 at the singularity? The GXX blows up at t equal to 0. Um, Yeah, the important thing is that PV also vanishes at the singularity. Actually, we can show it down in a line or two below that. But the two-sphere component, PC, is equal to zero at the singularity. And also PB is equal to zero. So that's how we're going to identify where the singularity is and the horizon are in the quantum effective dynamics. Okay. So in terms of going through and actually deriving the equations of motion, they can be solved explicitly. And obviously you're going to get back the Schwarzschild solution when you assume you can start your evolution, for instance, at the horizon with boundary values and then solve the equations of motion. And you get the Schwarzschild solution. So explicitly we have the PC component is T squared, and the PB component goes as T times the square root of 2m over T minus 1. And from there you can see if I plug in T equal to 0, which is the singularity, then I find that PB is 0 and also PC is 0. And so that gives back our identification of the singularity. And so forth. You can get B as a the connection components, but those aren't too important. Important parts of the triad behavior. So, in terms of interpreting the quantum effects, what I'm going to show today is, well, first of all, as I said, the PC component is related to the G omega omega, the omega omega metric component. And so that's directly related to the physical radius of the two-sphere. So we're going to use that knowledge. And also, if we take a test particle and we get an effective metric, we can calculate radial geodesics, for instance, and ask what happens for an infalling particle. And that's just going to satisfy the geodesic equation. In terms of these triad variables, the geodesic equation is just dt, t is coordinate time with respect to d tau. Tau would be the proper time. That quantity squared is just given by the factor on the right. So pc times epsilon squared. Epsilon would be the energy at infinity divided by pb squared plus 2, and then all of it divided by the lap squared. So we can, once we have solved for pc as a function of time and PB is a function of time, then we can integrate this equation and get the behavior of the radial geodesic. Okay? Are there any questions so far?
Go ahead.
Okay. So let's move on to slide number 6. So now I want to get into how we deal with trying to analyze the quantum dynamics. And so it is a homogeneous model, as I've just shown, and it's very similar to a loop quantum cosmology model, so it can be quantized in completely analogous fashion. And as I mentioned, this was done in 2006. What the end result is that you get a quantum difference equation that would have finite step sizes in terms of the triad variables PB and PC. And ideally what we'd like to do is construct semi-classical states, determine a physical inner product, calculate expectation values of Dirac observables. But I mentioned earlier this becomes quite complicated if you want to do an improved mu-bar-like quantization. In particular, if you have a mu-bar quantization, the discrete structure of the difference equation is going to be much more complicated. So what we've done is simplified things and just look at incorporating the Hanami effects. As I said, this phenomenological theory that just incorporates these effects and looks at a modified classical Hamiltonian. Classical in the sense that, not in that it gives classical GR, but it gives a modified classical theory. But again, the equations of motion that you're dealing would be classical and not quantum. And so we derive equations of motion and analyze those. So the key point is that I'm going to be showing you a modified classical Hamiltonian, and then once that has been determined, you can go through the equations of motion and derive what you want to derive. Particular to and where these effects are coming from is the fact that if you look at a holonomy in terms of these symmetry-reduced variables, they're going to look like, in a rough sense, exponentials of the connection components. So, for instance, if you had a classical in the Hamiltonian, if you had a classical term that looked like the connection component B, in the quantum theory, you're going to get an exponential of the connection components. It's going to be something like e to the I times b multiplied by some parameter delta b. And where these delta b, you would have a delta c term also. These are just proportional to the holonomy edge length that you use to construct the Hamiltonian constraint operator. So they're going to play an important role in measuring the effects of the quantum effects in that might arise in the difference equation. So in particular, larger values of delta mean stronger quantum effects. You can kind of see that if I have e to the I b times delta b, then if delta b is small, that's going to go to, well, it's going to go to 1 plus I times b delta b, but you can recover connection components b in the limit that the delta parameters go to 0. And these delta parameters are related to these, what we keep saying, mu naught and the mu bar parameters of loop quantum cosmology. So in the work of Eshtekar and Boyevold, these delta parameters were taken to be constants. And they're completely analogous to the mu naught parameter that went into the original works of loop quantum cosmology. So in the first work, in the Schwarzschild interior, those were taken to be constants. And that's completely analogous. So, as I mentioned, the more recent work in loop quantum cosmology, these parameters, these delta Bs and delta Cs, have been taken not to be constant anymore, but actually depend explicitly on the triad components. And there's some strong motivation for why this should be. And the end result is that we get better possible limit and more physical results.
Kevin?
Yeah.
Just to clarify at this stage, so you sort of emphasize that you've got a modified classical Hamiltonian, etc. But these parameters delta have H bar in them. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly. And therefore, what you call the classical Hamiltonian, although it's a function on the phase space, its expression would actually contain factors of H bar. Is this correct?
It would make sense. It's like a classical Hamiltonian plus corrections. Those corrections would be dependent on H bar.
Thank you.
For the Planck length or what you want.
Kevin, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
This is Carlo from Marseille, and this question is late. I should have asked before when you were looking for questions, but I'm just late in thinking. You have four variables, so 2 degrees of freedom, 1 constraint, so one physical degree of freedom in the model, just the gravitational part, right? And so the space of solutions is supposed to be two-dimensional. One, I suppose, is n, the mass. What is the other parameter that differentiates solutions? Is there another one? Which is to the other part.
In the equation for C is a function of time.
Yeah, I think there is a, you are right, I think there is a tension between a phase-space framework and space-time framework, just as there is also for Bianchi 1 models, for example. And as Kevin just explained, in the phase-space framework, if you look at the solutions, there is an extra parameter.
Yeah.
But in the space-time framework, just using the space-time diffeomorphism freedom, one can show that those, that extra parameter doesn't matter. That is to say, they're all related to each other by some space-time diffeomorphisms. This is a subtle issue. It has to do with kind of, sometimes there is this tension between the Hamiltonian framework and what we think of as space-time metric, geometric framework. But okay. Maybe we can come back to that at the end if there is still issues.
Okay. So, thank you.
Think of it in terms of the Schwarzschild. Yeah, and then you also have a paper with Joseph many years ago, right?
Okay, thank you.
And I left it out for simplicity. And like Abe said, that whatever value it takes, it doesn't affect the actual physical results. Okay, is there anything else? Okay, so then we can move on to slide 7. Okay, so in terms of what the actual effect of Hamiltonian that we're working with looks like, it's just given right here. And like I said, when you have classical factors of the connection components, for instance, in the Hamiltonian, we have the first term goes like B times C. Then in the way we'd deal with those in terms of incorporating the holonomy effects is to replace those B and C terms with sine of B times delta B divided by delta B terms. And the same thing for C. And you can see that that's the effective and the second line that we're dealing with vector being replaced by a sine term. And if you look at it, like I said, the delta B parameters are measuring the effects, the quantum effects. So going to behave more classically. And you can see that if you were to take the limit of this effective Hamiltonian, just take delta B and delta C going to zero, then you would get back the classical Hamiltonian. And I must mention, you know, the caveats of the model we're working in. We're dealing in detail with the quantum theory. So this is a sort of, as I mentioned, a phenomenological theory that we're just looking at. We're considering what are the possible effects if we look at these types of corrections. Coming from the quantum theory itself, so there could be additional corrections that come from the quantum theory. In terms of the loop quantum, going to spend too much time on the results, but what he found is that the singularity is avoided in the effective and sphere radius component. So proportional to the G omega omega component, that is bounded to be above the value of a value that's proportional to the Mirzi parameter, to the value of the delta parameters, and also the mass of the black hole. And that's shown on the in this is sort of model would initially fall towards the singularity, which is his trajectory is given by the red line. This is the quantum effect, quantum trajectory. The black line would be the classical solution. So
okay, just to amplify this, Abhay, just to, Jorge was just mentioning that in fact, if you in this mu naught kind of quantization, you could choose these values of delta Vs and so on, such that there would be violation of the even at the classical level, right? There'll be contradictions with general relativity, even at, in domains where they should not be. Is that
yeah? Just like in another cosmological model, there's nothing new.
Right. So this is, but this looks like not what Kevin just replied to, because Kevin was saying that in this case there is no problem with the classical limit. So I just want to understand this tension.
I think he wants to say that if one looks at, I think like maybe we can postpone this discussion, but even in the loop quantum cosmology, unless you take a cosmological constant, you don't have the same classical limit. If you are just playing with a massless scale, you don't have any problems. But the problems are still there in a subtle way because there are issues of V naught and so on.
Obviously, in this talk, since we don't have a lot, infinite amount of time. amped oscillation and then settling into a kind of an equilibrium. So what we find again in this result is that the singularity is absent. This PC component is never. And so like in the work of Modesto, again we see that the singularity is absent, in that it's resolved dynamically.
Is the value of the effective cosmology constant given just by the area gap, or does it also depend on the mass of the initial black hole?
So the next thing would be what would happen classically, so that so in the red case is what's coming out of the effective then.
So, Kevin, just to get clarification.
So I have a last comment, which is that there is a little
be the case. Any issues. So I don't have any.
I mean, you mentioned this paper that Gaurav and Daniel Carlton and I wrote, which is about these stability issues, which are in fact also improved at this difference equation level for such a mu-bar stream, that the same one that you mentioned and discussed here. So the mu-naught instability issues are not there anymore in this scheme.
Mu-naught scheme is instable.
Was actually the observation that Gaurav and Daniel made earlier. Last year, I think. So that's why we looked at this, the different discretization and checked the stability there, and it turned out to be stable in this case.
Okay.
Jorge, can you relation between what Kevin is doing with the
paper that got delayed, which has essentially the same results of Kevin in page 7 with a mu-naught. We didn't do any slightly different treatment of things, and therefore results come out slightly different, but they're completely equivalent. So we're very happy with his treatment.
I mean, it is really completely analogous to the cosmological models, as everybody has emphasized. So, because in the cosmological models, it really is the initial data has to do with kind of the value of the momentum of the scalar field P phi. And choosing the momentum large, you can make departures from general relativity at low densities. And so here, the initial data will be the parameters like the mass, and choosing that, one could make departures from general relativity. That is what seems to be the case. I have a few questions, Kevin. I mean, if we can go to page 12.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to you to go through slowly with this triangular diagram of the of the final diagram, which is supposed to be triangular, right? So we got the horizon, and then you got various regions and slashed and unslashed lines and so on. So can you tell us what they are?
If you go to slide 10, I have the nereid line element there.
All right.
And there you have, in the GXX term, you have a square root of lambda.
That in fact, when you look at this, then probably that is analogous to what happens in quantum cosmology, that there is a repulsive force which is being, you know, counterbalanced, which counterbalances the attractive force, and therefore the particle remains as there. But there seems to be some slight difference here, right? Because in the case of quantum cosmology, this repulsive force is short-lived, but it completely overwhelms and kind of causes a bounce. So here, the particle is not kind of thrown away from what was would-be singularity, but remains at some finite distance. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. So, it doesn't... really does look like the bounce in loop quantum cosmology, where the PC.
I just have just two small comments now. And then there are other questions people want to ask here. The one small comment is that when Madhavan and Victor Tavares and I have looked at the CGHS black hole, we looked at it from a full quantum point of view, and then it looks like, even though there seems to be a semi-classical region, kind of to the quote-unquote to the future of the singularity, which is what is happening in your case also, around the region, around where the classical singularity was, the metric fluctuations are very large. Now, that is not something that can be checked in your effective equations, of course, but I think that is a very good motivation to really look at what happens, what would happen if one had looked at kind of quantum equations and not just the effective equations. I mean, one wants to know, is a situation like in quantum cosmology where basically you can actually write down a good semi-classical metric, that is to say the continuum picture seems to be quite fine throughout the bounds, or is there a region where this continuum picture really is bad and there are large metric fluctuations? And that, I think, is something that would be good to check. But as you said, that would require a lot of very careful work.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I wholeheartedly agree.
Okay. And the second was a very short comment, and this is really to Carlo's question. Carlo, I just quickly dug out the paper that Martina and I wrote And on page 396 and 97, the point that you just raised is discussed in some detail.
Can I react on that?
Yes, please.
I guess is what I wanted to ask. I mean, for those of us who are less, the Hamiltonian, because this is the, so I'm gonna physically, what is exactly what I'm describing here? What are the in the quantum cosmology case, I was, as far as the little I understand, I mean, I'm sort of, I have a good physical intuition if I think that I can approximate a wave packet, the evolution of a wave packet across the singularity, and there is a notion, this is how I there is a notion of when the approximation with respect to a classical solution is good or bad. So here, first of all, I'm confused for two things. One, I have the physics clear in the cosmological case because there is a scalar field. So I sort of see clearly where are the degrees of freedom, what is one describing. While here, without the scalar field, I'm a little bit lost on what are the actual degrees of freedom we're talking about. There is a wave packet in what? Is this a wave packet of black holes with different masses, one with respect to the other and with a phase or whatever? And the second question is, where does the approximation go wrong? I mean, is that goes wrong somewhere before this sort of peculiar universe on the other side with a fixed area develops? So on the other hand, I cross a region in which the approximation go bad, and then I go back to a classical region or not? Maybe that's what you were saying also by...
Yeah.
I don't know, this is not a clear question, but I...
No, I think at least to me, it's pretty clear. So maybe Kevin wants to say something. If not, I can also add a few things.
Yes, thanks.
So in terms of knowing where it goes wrong, we don't have a good idea exactly. I mean, we only have... Because the main problem is we don't have... Evolving semi-classical states and everything is complicated, so we don't know exactly where things will go wrong. And so I can't give you a good answer that precisely is there some region in this dynamics where we expect this approximation to go wrong or not.
There is a naive answer, at least I don't know if it's a good one, which is that what one is doing is replacing a variable by the sign of the variable, and therefore this is good when the variable is small.
Which variable are you talking about?
When you do write this Hamiltonian, it differs from the classical Hamiltonian.
Oh, the sign. Are you sure? You mean B?
Yeah.
Sign B. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that is one way of looking at it.
And when is B small on the evolution?
Well, B is small when it follows the classical. In all these plots that I have,
it's small in both regions, right? Close to the singularity and also close to the horizon. Is that right?
Not necessarily.
Oh, that's PC. That's PB.
PB would be small. That's correct. I mean, it's slightly complicated because we really want to look at, for instance, delta B times B and delta C times C. But in our case, it is when these things become non-small is that when you expect the quantum effects to show up. And that's what I am looking at here is when these things not become small. That's what generates the differences from the classical behavior.
So in the classical theory, both B and C become large near the singularity. And the
viewpoint, I guess, that Kevin is expressing is that is exactly the regime in which quantum effect should be, quote-unquote, large if you're going to get deviation from classical theory. And so the effects are large there. So there is no, quote-unquote, obvious inconsistency there. I mean, we would not want discrepancy in regions where the curvature is low. And roughly, that is where the B and C are, in fact, small. And so...
Yeah. So, but can I tell, yeah, yes, but isn't that also the region where this approximation is supposed to go bad?
Okay, so let me start from scratch.
That's what I guess that's what's confusing me. I mean,
okay, so the real way to do this calculation is the following, right? One should really do the quantum calculation and then obtain effective equations from full quantum theory and then see what happens. Now, to a very good degree of approximation, this is what has been done in quantum cosmology.
Right.
And in unpublished work, Victor Tavares, which will be submitted very soon, has actually done it also for mu bar evolution.
Okay. Right.
So that it is that one has actually started out with quantum theory and semi-classical states and then showing that, in fact, you get some effective equations. Okay. And then the statement is that, well, those effective equations, in fact, incorporate all the quantum effects. And not surprisingly, those effective equations show that, first of all, they agree with classical general relativity in the low curvature region, and they disagree with the classical general relativity in the high curvature region. But there, we are not surprised, because...
Sure, of course, yes.
But the key point there is the logic is that in the high curvature region, we did not just postulate something, but we obtained effective equations starting from full quantum theory. Now, having gained that insight, one can go back and examine that result and say that, well, supposing I was very clever and I did not really know the full quantum theory, could I have guessed what the effective equation should be?
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns out that, in fact, there is no logical justification for this, as I have emphasized many, many times. But it turns out, nonetheless, a useful fact is that, yes, it really is wherever the connection components occur, you replace them by sine of that divided by something. And therefore, in the present case, in the black hole case, we do not really have a good control so far on the full quantum theory, I mean, the mini-superspace quantum theory. Nobody has really constructed wave packets and derived the semi-classical equations in any consistent way. But if you like, this is a useful guess. And it is, because it is a guess, it is really open to the kind of criticisms you are just making. Namely, that the departures are large near the singularity, so why should I trust these effective equations? You're absolutely right. A priori, I don't know. But it's just that there is some experience gained in simple models which suggests that this is not a completely stupid thing to do. I think that is my viewpoint towards all this. And the thing that I was just mentioning to Kevin a while ago is that if for two-dimensional black holes, CGHS black holes, one looks at quantum theory, then one finds that, in fact, there is a region where effective equations actually fail. And yet, on the other side, so the effective equations are again very good. And so this is something that one has to actually check here more carefully. There is, as Kevin has emphasized many times, we should not take these effective equations as a final word, but just as something that is giving us some insight in between, with all the caveats that Carlo has pointed out.
Thanks. Yeah. Now it's much clearer, the picture. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, and you also asked about understanding what would be the degrees of freedom in the quantum theory. In this case,
how would I think about the wave packet? Is the wave packet of what? I mean,
in this case where we wouldn't have a scalar field, but you still have a degree of freedom, as you pointed out early in the talk. One could take, for instance, a wave function as a function of both the triad components, let's say PB and PC, and then think of it as a wave function of PB evolving with respect to PC. So something along that line. Whereas in loop quantum cosmology, it would just be a wave function of the triad component P and the scalar field phi.
Yes, but one of the two you're telling me is not doesn't have any direct physical interpretation. Do I still have to?
I don't think that would necessarily be a problem.
Think of this as being a clock somehow, the one which does not have physical interpretation.
Oh, I see. So you can think as a clock. Is that the thing which is a clock at infinity that? No.
Well, in this model, it is true that the one that we are thinking of as clock is exactly one which is not relevant finite.
Oh, I see. So the other variable is sort of the initial time at infinity, when one starts with a space. Is that something?
Yes.
I see. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Hi, Kevin. It's Mikhail. I would like to come back to Param's question, the first Param question, about inverse triad correction. So, there is not really a page. I would like to refer to the first graph on page 11, I guess. So when PC becomes small, so we should expect one might naively expect that it would make the gravity force more repulsive and probably change the equilibrium value of PC, maybe make it larger. What do you think about it?
I'm not sure exactly how it would affect things. One of the problems that we face is that in terms of determining where the inverse triad effects occur, they're dependent on these gauge issues that we've mentioned in other points in this talk. So I could choose a gauge where that quantum effects occur at very large values of PC, these inverse triad effects. But we have chosen, because of these gauge issues, we have chosen not to consider that. So to answer your question, I don't know exactly how it would affect things. We didn't look at that specifically.
Then how should I understand this graph, which gives this equilibrium value of PC to be like Plankian size?
In what sense to...
So you're saying that it depends on the gauge?
This graph here on slide 11 is not considering any inverse triad effects. It's resulting from my effective Hamiltonian without inverse triad effects.
Right. I'm saying that this PC value is really small.
In the case of inverse triad effects, because of the gauge issues, you can have them occur at any value of PC that you would like.
Uh-huh.
And so, wherever those effects show up, your theory doesn't tell you whether 0.2 Planck length squared is larger than where the inverse triad effects occur, or whether it's smaller than where the inverse triad effects occur.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Any other questions? Okay, so no further questions. Let's thank Kevin again. And we'll see each other, I guess, next semester then.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.